Hello, everybody.
Hi, Andrew.
Hello. Hi, Mike.
Servus.
Hi, Graham. Hi, Ben.
Hello.
And hello, listeners. Welcome to the Linux Voice Podcast, Series 3, Episode 6. I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Ben Everard.
I'm Graham Morrison.
And I'm Mike Saunders.
And in today's fun-packed podcast, we have news. We have a halfway reminder, our finds of the fortnight, voice of the masses, and perhaps, just maybe, some brains to speak from Mike. Let's crack on without further ado. News.
Right, this fortnight, the top news story is that PIA, Private Internet Access, has become the primary sponsor of Linux Mint. They're an American company that provide VPNs for people who don't want people snooping on their internet connections. They've said they're doing it because a lot of their in-house staff use Linux Mint and because they generally like supporting open source software.
I mean, how they could be a really good company and they could be doing their utmost for privacy and the like, but if they're based in the US, aren't they still susceptible to all these government requests?
Well, this is the kind of, but actually the EU would be far worse because the EU has a mandatory data retention law that may or may not be a real law and may or may not be illegal. But it means that internet providers probably have to store all internet communication for 2 years or more in some countries. Whereas in America, they've actually got much stronger protections on freedom of speech, which means that while they probably are still listening in and storing it, they'll at least have the decency to do it quietly and not tell you they're doing it. So, long story short, they're listening in everywhere.
But this was a story about Linux Mint, wasn't it? Is this the US subsidiary to Blue Systems?
Not as far as I'm aware.
Sorry. Linux Mint has always done okay for money, hasn't it? And I suppose it's been like a couple of years since I last looked.
I mean, they've certainly got quite a long list of sponsors, and I think they've got a lot of sort of loyal users that donate what they can as well. So I don't have access to their finances, but as far as I'm aware, they're doing reasonably well.
Yeah, they're going through their quietly successful phase. It seems, you know, they've just been carrying on doing a great job. Yeah. You know, it's still a very, very popular distribution.
Yeah. So what is he predicting that in 18 months to a year or so, they're going to reinvent the desktop paradigm in some crashingly awful way?
You heard it here first. Speaking of reinventing the desktop paradigm, next up is another distro that's trying to raise money. Elementary has just released Freya. But to download this, you have to the download button links to a payment form where you're asked to donate.
They've learned from the lessons of the last time, then.
Yeah, well, I might be misremembering this, but I thought when they first did it, there was like a big pay now button and underneath a little okay download anyway link. But on the new form, all there is payment options. You've got $10, $25, $50 and custom amount and then the big pay download button. And the only way to get it, if you don't want to donate, is to put in a zero in the custom amount and hit pay now. But it's not at all obvious that that's even possible.
No, I mean, at least this time they're not accusing people of cheating the system.
Not yet.
Not yet. It'd be nice if they showed, when you put in a number, it'd be nice if they showed how much money they give back to Debian and Ubuntu, because otherwise their elementary OS is cheating the system by taking free software. It was a ridiculous thing to do. And I was looking at like Reddit and Slashdot threads about elementary OS, and there were overwhelmingly people saying, I'm never going to use this distro again. What they said was stupid and offensive, and it really was.
Do you think this is like the meeting point between kind of startup culture and open source, though? Because elementary OS, they spend a lot of money. They've got salaries to pay, and they put a lot of effort into design. So they need to make some money somehow.
Yeah, great, but you know, do it by not accusing your users
of
being
cheated. How do they do it? They probably haven't found another way of doing it. It's the same with Arda.
But then, you know, then it's a bad business model if that's the way, you know, Red Hat makes money, loads of other companies make money. If the only way to make money is by guilt-tripping your users, then they should...
Well, that's basically the whole freemium gameplay model, isn't it?
No, that's where it tries to get young children addicted to games.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, they could come up with, if they actually came up with a full 1.0 release of the distro, they could sell like box sets with, you know, extra codecs and documentation and stuff. That would be cool. Great.
But that's been tried time and time again, and it doesn't work. People don't want to pay for desktop Linux.
Probably what they'll start doing is they'll add loads of lovely menu options and applications that when you click on it will ask you for 29 cents to enable this feature.
This is an add-on item.
I'm not against them trying. I agree with you about the way that they're trying it, and it isn't the way that we're used to people in the community trying to do stuff. But, you know, if it works, if it gets them money and it means that it continues development, then is that such a bad thing?
No, it's not a bad thing, but it's just unlikely to work.
Yeah.
I think the biggest issue is, in this, it doesn't feel like you're donating. It feels like you're buying a product because of the way it is. And if you buy a product, you expect it to be supported. So if they're prepared to...
I buy a product from British Telecom every month, and it is totally unsupported.
Yeah, it's true.
But, I mean, you don't get any support with rubbish apps off the App Store when you spend your £1 or £2.
Yeah, but can't you get a refund if they don't work?
Well,
I've never tried.
In theory, you can get a refund within a certain period of time. But
and it's not £1 or £2. $10 was the minimum. And, you know, they're pushing for 25, I think, was the default. Maybe that's just what I clicked on first.
It would only take... also $999,999 the form as well. So if you really want to donate $1 million, you can't do it.
maybe the answer is to distribute Elementary on vinyl discs. Because that's you know, that's coming back, isn't it? You know, when you've got a physical possession there, you treasure it. Whereas anything that you download is just ephemeral.
And when you boot it up, the screen's just a little bit fuzzy, but everyone tells you that's warm.
Yeah,
warm. And the clear-looking stuff, it doesn't look as good.
Yeah, it's just so clinical, it's just cold.
In a slightly related news story, I don't know if this is mentioned, but Karen Sandlin on Twitter of the GNOME Foundation mentioned yesterday the launch of Endless Computers on Kickstarter, which is this tiny self-contained PC. It's the same kind of story, an affordable PC for lots of people in lots of different situations and parts of the world. It looks really neat. But what's particularly neat is the version of GNOME, the GNOME desktop that they demo in their prototype videos, which looks like a Kodi XBMC interface to applications and launch up and stuff like that. It actually looks like a really nice part of GNOME Shell doing something real for people who don't know about computers or are just learning how to use computers. That was the most impressive part of it for me.
I've spent a lot of time with people who don't use computers and working in schools in Tanzania and that, and I found that almost everyone finds a traditional desktop manager fairly intuitive. People understand menus and windows relatively easily. I don't think we need some stripped-down, kiddie interface and just assume people are stupid and can't understand computers. They're not that complicated. Desktop managers work in the way they used to.
But could that be like people from a previous generation, people who were brought up on like Windows or Windows 95? That's the expectations of what a computer could be, and now it's kind of changed because now people are used to prodding on their phones.
But this was people who had never used computers before or smartphones, and they got it.
Yeah, I agree with this. So it's like explaining to my parents how to do things. With more traditional interfaces, you can say click X in the menu and go to Y. Now you look at things like all these desktops with abstract icons, like three circles next to each other. When you're describing this on the phone, click the three circly thing next to the backward pointing arrow, not the forward pointing arrow. Google does this a lot with Android. It's just horrible. I can't understand how they work most of the time.
I've never had any success talking people through things on the telephone. It usually takes hours, and it's many years of pain.
Yeah. Just copy and paste this line into your terminal, press enter.
If I can get SSH running remotely, that's the answer. But everything else, Well, I think it looks good. I think you've got to have a look at it. It's not like a totally dumbed down version of GNOME. It looks good.
Okay. Well, we want to keep an eye on. Next news item, Thunderbird 38 is in beta. This is Mozilla's email client. But the key news story about this is that it's not Mozilla, although it kind of is. It's still hosted by Mozilla. But Mozilla are no longer developing it. This is done by the community. The Mozilla team have said they're too busy, I don't know, playing with JavaScript to make buttons spin on web browsers or something. And no, to be fair, Mozilla are actually some really interesting stuff. But apparently they're too busy to make an email client. Probably the key feature of this is it supports MailDIR, which is sort of an email archiving system used by quite a few of the clients and works well with sort of large message boxes and the like. So it's the first release in quite a while, as I recall.
Yeah, I think the thing with mail clients like Thunderbird is they can be pretty much done, can't they? With web browsers, there's constantly new technologies coming down the line, but email clients, yeah, you just want something reliable and...
I don't know why I'm feeling so argumentative today, but I mean, people probably thought that web browsers were done when Internet Explorer 4 came out or when Netscape came out. You know, I think it just takes somebody to come along. And I mean, Geary was quite innovative in the way that it tries to display email, just so prohibitive in the way that it doesn't offer any configuration options. I think a lot can be done in email. I don't know what, but, you know, somebody could come along and... I'm not satisfied with webmail, that's for sure. I like to have an application that I can use. I think there's loads of room for improvement. In Apple's mail, for example, I really like the way that the whole thread is displayed, including the emails you've sent and the emails you've received all in one stream. And I haven't found a Linux email client that does the same thing.
I thought Geary did that, actually.
Actually, yeah, Geary does, but I can't use Geary. Ah. You're right, yeah. That's why I'd taken a look at Geary. Kmail can do something close, but not quite.
I'm completely the other way around. I only use webmail because otherwise I download mail to one computer and then I log in on another and I get confused and lose things. And I'm not very good with email anyway, to be honest.
Well, maybe it'd be better if email just did die. I think that would be a nice option.
I mean, I'm kind of ambivalent about email because on the one hand, it's a massively outdated system that really could be replaced by something much better. But on the other hand, it's the only... As far as I can recall, it's the only really federated communication system that's in any way popular.
I love it when you say federated. It means we're talking serious stuff now.
Because if thing is, if email dies, it's going to be replaced with like WhatsApp or Facebook chat. And which is just worse. Email should die, but there's nothing better.
No. There needs to we've talked about it before. There needs to be a super secure, encrypted, easy to use version of email
that's still federated.
That's still federated. Oh, thank you.
Maybe that's what Mozilla are working on. They're not doing Thunderbird because they're creating the future.
The last time I tried Thunderbird, it was a huge, big, bloated application. Interestingly, I know you hate that phrase, Andrew. Karen Sandler uses it as her default email client the last time I spoke to her.
Right, I think that's about all we can say on email for the time being.
I can go on.
One of the ways I get news for this is I do a Google News search for Linux, and the thing that popped up, a whole stream of them, of articles popped up saying Microsoft releases new Windows Server to compete with Linux. And I actually missed this news story when it first came out before I was putting it together. But the news story is they've released Server Nano, Windows Server Nano, which is a stripped-down version of Windows.
Text editor.
Yes. It's a stripped-down version of Windows to work with containers and sort of compete with CoreOS, really. But what was far more interesting to me is that Microsoft feels a need now to compete with Linux. They feel they've lost this market and they're trying to win it back, not by marketing, not by advertising harder, but by trying to re-implement the features that Linux has had for quite a while.
Yeah. I think that...
Who says they're competing?
Well, news
Microsoft
sites, to be
honest.
They're
competing, or is that just the way that the news has been reported?
That's a good question, and I have no idea. It's certainly the way the news has been reported.
Okay. But wasn't this supposed to be what Windows RT did?
Well, Windows RT was for mobile and whatnot, wasn't it?
But wouldn't that have provided a small kind of embedded system that they're going to be used? Is this good for that, or is this their approach on Docker or containers or trying to do that kind of stuff?
This is to go with containers against, yeah, Docker and, basically cloud things.
So they can probably see that this is a huge growth market and they don't have something that they can swap in place for, you know, a tiny 200 megabyte Linux operating system.
Exactly, yeah. If you want to spin up 1,000 instances really quickly, you can do that with CoreOS. But
yeah,
what are you going to do it with Windows?
Yeah, I guess they're a big enough company. They can. It doesn't have to be significant. They can just see an emerging market and create something to compete with it. So at least they have something to provide to their customers.
Yeah, I mean, one of the big downsides I can see for Windows in this is just the hassle of managing licenses. Oh, I want to spin up a new cloud. Oh, hang on, I've got to go and find a license key that's not being used.
And then call up some support line, you know, asking them to activate 1,000 installations of Snappy Windows or whatever it's called.
Yeah, just get told 1,000 times you're pirating stuff. You've stolen this unless you can prove you haven't.
The terminal goes red.
Yeah. You wouldn't download a car. Oh.
Yeah. You wouldn't download a server. Oh, yes, you would. You wouldn't download a Linux distribution for free. Oh, hang on.
It's interesting for Linux to get some competition in this this area. It's quite new and there's a lot of ways it could go. And I think the flexibility of Linux is going to be really hard to compete with from Microsoft's point of view on this one.
And I think when your competitor starts to copy some of your features, it's a sign that you're doing something right.
Yeah. Old Gandhi quote, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they do something else, then you win.
Yeah, and we've just had something else as well, that Microsoft has been very eager to get Windows on the Raspberry Pi, for instance. There's another instance of Linux being there first, and now Microsoft's running around like a headless chicken wondering what to do.
Yeah, and it's another situation where Microsoft, they can put it on the Raspberry Pi, but it's just not going to have the features. Until you can apt get anything on Windows, it's going to be a second-rate OS on the Raspberry Pi and in the cloud.
Mm. And licensing is going to be a nightmare.
Oh, I suspect they're going to give free licenses for Raspberry Pi.
It'll be like Minecraft, I guess, yeah.
If they don't, they've just massively failed.
Yeah.
Because the license would be more than the Raspberry Pi. Right, let's get back to some Linux news. That's enough talking about proprietary software. Manjaro had something of a certificate fail this week. They forgot to renew their SSL certificate. So when you went onto their website, it said, oh, there's a security fail. And they put up a blog post saying, don't worry about this. Just change your system date to a week ago and it'll all work fine.
That was what I found shocking about it, was their suggestion of a solution. It wasn't. It was terrible.
Yeah, especially given that you can just click don't worry about this error. I don't know. I think they got a bit of unfair criticism for this, because a lot of people said that they should put up a self-signed certificate. But actually, an expired certificate is, I think, more secure than a self-signed certificate, because self-signed certificate can be man in the middle, where an expired certificate can't. It's not a good solution. And yes, there is a very slim chance that you'll go to another computer that's had its certificate compromised in the last week and they've expired the certificate and you will somehow get attacked. But that was very unlikely.
I didn't really understand why it was such a huge story, because it's a simple mistake.
It is, and this one, the major companies did it. I mean, didn't Microsoft do it about a year ago, forget to renew their SSL certificate?
I certainly remember some big stories of companies where this happens. It's that they have the capabilities of getting a solution a lot quicker than the Manjaro team did.
Yeah. And it's another one of those sort of holes it's easy to fall into, because security on the internet doesn't really work very well, and it's all bits hacked on afterwards rather than something that was baked in from the start. But yeah, it's probably safer not to set your clock back a week if you forget to renew your SSL certificate. And last up on our list of news this fortnight, Debian gets a new project leader, Neil McGovern. And he's got a whole sort of website on what his stuff is, and I only read the bits in bold. So I'll read out the bits in bold from his website. So, support and enable, that's apparently important. Push for implementation of PPAs. Push for the engagement of non-packaging aspects of Debian contributors. Continue to communicate. Spend money.
Apparently the software in the public interest that's behind Debian has $200,000 sitting in the bank, and he said, let's use that money instead of just having it sitting there doing nothing.
I mean, that's a fair reason. He can spend it on Linux Voice subscriptions for Debian contributors if he wants.
He can spend it on an SSL certificate.
I do find it a bit surprising that Debian doesn't have something equivalent to PPAs at this point. It's a really nice feature, I think. And I don't know, maybe it is too tied, because it's tied into Launchpad and all that sort of stuff. So it might be quite Ubuntu specific rather than Debian, but I can't imagine it's that much work to pull it back.
I think a similar system would be great in that Debian can remain being extremely stable and slow moving, but if you want a new subset of software, you can just add a PPA. I mean, you can do that at the moment with the backports repository, but that's like another giant lump to add on.
Yeah, and the PPAs you can do for specific bits of software, so if you don't want every new bit or every old bit, you just grab the PPA for the bit you want. I mean, I have hundreds of PPAs on my Ubuntu system, and which is probably why it's massively unstable. But I think it's a system that works really well, and it's one I'd really like to see in other distros. And if it goes into Debian, it will obviously flow through into all the Debian derivatives. In fact, most Debian derivatives can probably be replaced with a PPA.
Yeah.
So does he mention systemd at all? I know this has only just happened and you've only read out what's in bold, but
He doesn't put it in bold, I can tell you that much. Hang on, I'm just seeing if I've still got the tab open. I have.
We should move on and learn from the experience.
No, systemd comes up naught times on my Firefox find. And that's all the news this fortnight.
Awesome, that was more like the lightning news of old. It's early and sunny.
Lightning news plus a rant against email.
Okay, thanks, Ben. Thanks for the excellent news, as always. It's now time for finds of the fortnight. Anybody want to go first? Mike, were you able to find a find?
Yeah, this episode, I actually have my own homegrown find for the first time in many, many moons. For issue 15 of the magazine, which we just put to bed last week, I did a feature on emulators, and I was messing around with one emulator called MedNAFEN. It's a multi-system emulator, so it emulates Game Boy, NES, Mega Drive, Super NES, and so forth. And I found that if you press Alt and S, you can, while you're playing a game, you can hold backspace and go back in time from what you were doing. So it literally just reverses time. So you can go back up to 10 seconds ago. So if you make a mistake, you can go back. Now, where this becomes especially useful is when you make a recording. You can record the gameplay, so all the keyboard inputs and the state of RAM. So if you make a movie and then you make a mistake and hit backspace, it goes back in the movie as well. Ooh. So in this way, you can do speed runs, tool-assisted speed runs. So
you can cheat at speed runs.
You can cheat, yeah. there are loads of tools to do this, but they're normally forks of emulators and quite complicated to set up. But this is a quick way to make a movie, go through a game, backspace whenever you make a mistake, and the end results make you look like an absolute god at the game.
That's really good. Or if there's some random element in game, you know, you could keep going back until you've got all of the right numbers or whatever it happens to be. It would look awesome.
Exactly, exactly. I was really impressed with Mednafen. I've heard of it before. I hadn't really used it. I tend to use dedicated emulators for each console. But this covers a large number of consoles. It even plays Super NES games without stuttery audio, which is kind of what I expect on a 2.5 gigahertz machine anyway. But yeah, I really like it.
There's a game I got in a Humble Bundle a while ago. I think it's called Time Surfer, where the whole mechanic of the game is that you can rewind time and gain, I guess, rewind credits. And you can't really see what's going on, so you have to fly through the game until something goes wrong, and then you rewind time, and you have to try and save up enough time to be able to rewind from stuff.
That sounds cool. That sounds really innovative, yeah.
Yeah, it's quite an interesting game.
One of the Prince of Persia sequels did that as well. It was Sands of Time, where what do you call those things with sand in that you turn over?
Hourglass.
Thanks, an hourglass. That would allow you to rewind the last 30 seconds, which is really good as well as a game mechanic. Excellent. I did ask the IRC channel just before we came on. Interestingly... I just say that to fill time while I'm actually reading the screen. Devilment says that you can use SCP to copy between two remote servers other than the one that you're on, which I didn't know about.
Yeah, I've used that quite a few times. I've used it quite a few times for moving ISO files between servers because it can take a while to download and upload. And if you happen to have two servers in the same data center, it's very quick just to shuffle them about and it saves opening an SSH session.
Do you know if the data goes through your machine?
It's certainly fast enough that it doesn't appear to.
Oh, that is clever. And then there doesn't have to be any kind of authentication credentials between those two servers as long as there was between you your machine. I mean, I know you don't know these answers. I'm just asking.
I think the ones I did it on were password authenticated rather than certificate authenticated. I'm just trying to think if I've done it on our current servers. I don't think I have.
So I suppose for people who don't know, SCP is kind of a part of SSH that allows you to, you know, the CP command on the command line allows you to copy files. SCP is a secure copy that allows you to copy from one server to another or from a local directory to a remote server, basically over SSH as an encrypted copy. It's very, very useful.
Yeah, I've started using rsync a lot more recently, mostly because I've got a rubbish internet connection and the rsyncs, can restart.
Yeah, yeah. I can never remember. SCP, I can at least remember the syntax in my head, whereas rsync, I always have to look it up.
Yeah.
P. Waring says that someone is doing a .NET implementation for LLVM. So Microsoft's recently open sourced .NET. I guess I don't know what it builds on, but if it's going to start building an LLVM, I guess that's a good thing. He says it's a set of cross-platform .NET code generation tools that enables compilation of MSIL bytecode to LLVM supported platforms.
So is .NET a bytecode then?
I think it always has been, yeah.
And this would be a back end to allow you to run that bytecode through LLVM.
I guess, yeah, so the end result is that you could distribute effectively binaries that were .NET applications.
Okay.
They're the only two finds on IRC this morning. There's a bit of a conversation, but I'd have to say interestingly again if I read through it, so I'm going to avoid that. Shall I do my find? Mine's kind of small find, but it's a small command on GitHub called playerctl, playercontrol. And what it does is it uses dbus to send multimedia commands to applications like VLC or Spotify, the kind of stuff that automatically defaults to play, pause, and fast forward and rewind on your keyboard. But you can use playerctl to send those commands to your system, so whatever is playing can be paused or rewound or fast forwarded. It's really useful for scripts, but what I found it specifically useful for is to assign the play pause keys on my keyboard to those functions when those functions are lost, especially in KD. KD seems to have bad behavior when it comes to sending those signals, or actually the Spotify app specifically doesn't grab the multimedia input from those keys. So you can force it by using KD's excellent global keyboard bindings to run this player CTL command with the right arguments for playing stuff. Works remotely, and it's a really useful little tool.
So you could pair this up with an SSH app on your Android phone to make the world's geekiest remote control.
Yeah, very easily. Yeah, there's all kind. Yeah, it's really useful because that never seems to work, or it's never very consistent, those play, pause, rewind keys. Another interesting site, I listen to Spotify quite a lot, so I sometimes plug my phone into the amp and listen to it, and then use my laptop from some distance away. And now with the latest version of Spotify, the proprietary app that's available for Linux, you can remote control another instance of Spotify, so I can control the playlist on my phone from the Linux desktop app, which is kind of neat. That's it. That's my find.
Shall I go next?
Yeah.
Last weekend, I was playing with my Raspberry Pi, and I was playing with Docker, actually. There's a new SDE image by a team called Hypriot, or Hypriot, I'm not sure how you pronounce it. There's just a minimal SD image with Docker running on it. And then there's some containers built by some calling themselves Resin. So you can just quickly spin up these, just pull these images and run all sorts of stuff in Docker containers. The one I'm using it for at the moment is I've got a Docker container running WeChat acting as an IRC relay, and I can then connect to it using the Glowing Bear HTML interface. So I can connect that through my phone or my laptop or wherever through this Docker container running on a Raspberry Pi at home. I'm not entirely sure what the advantage of having all this set up is, rather than just, using an IRC client.
It sounds so complicated. I mean, when you look at the simplicity of IRC, ASCII through Telnet, and then you've got a web server running on some Docker client going to your phone through HTTP.
It is quite nice to have the same session on my laptop as my phone, as my desktop.
Yeah.
But it is massively overkill.
I use ZNC on our servers. Yeah. Which works or does almost the same thing, and you can have more than one client connect at the same time.
But it doesn't use Docker, so it must be outdated.
Yeah, that is true. I won't tell you where I built the binary for it because it's running on our server.
I also played some other things. I got Etherpad spun up in a container and OwnCloud just to sort of have a bit of a play with it, really, and. The performance of the hard drive layer, the overlay FS on Docker on the Raspberry Pi is appalling. I assume that's what was slowing it down. I didn't do too much looking at it, but getting the OwnCloud install was hours. It was just running in the background and I was doing other stuff, but it took a ridiculous amount of time. But once it's all built, it does actually, it runs reasonably well. I wouldn't try running anything too heavy on it. But if you just want something to play about with Docker, Raspberry Pi is actually quite a good option.
It'd be nice if the Raspberry Pi had a SATA port or an eSATA port.
Yeah, or just some sort of disk access that wasn't ridiculously slow.
Yeah. And USB, I assume, isn't going to solve the problem either.
No. There are other sort of small computers that do have faster disk access.
Yeah. Cool. Andrew?
I haven't discovered anything.
Have you found anything, though?
No, I've not. It's appalling.
Well, the weather has been rather nice. Okay, so...
No, up here it hasn't.
No, actually, I saw that. It's been warm in the south of England and cold in the north. Who'd have thought it?
Is that this week or just this last decade, or
just forever? It's so grim.
Right, so there are fines. Thanks.
That brings us hurtling along to a halfway reminder. Still to come, we've got The Voice of the Masses and maybe, just maybe, a Neuron read out by Mike Saunders. If you like the sound of this and would like to read it on paper or maybe on a screen, you can subscribe to Linux Voice at shop.linuxvoice.com.
There have been no neurons this episode, I regret to announce. We are sorry for the delay to this service. But if anybody does want a neuron vocalized, then email me, mike@linuxvoice.com.
Sounds like we should have a neuron replacement bus.
or a neuron replacement section. What are some of the old sections we could bring back? We used to have good rants, didn't we? The
spin the wheel thing.
Oh, yeah.
A rants and raves.
But we did it for quite a long time, and we pretty much ranted about everything in the end.
But surely there's more stuff to be angry about now. Yeah. There's System D, for instance.
We could just cut our bit about email and bring it down.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or, if Graham can't be bothered to do that, listeners, just imagine that that's what we've done.
we need the wheel of misfortune, though. Where did we leave it? I think we left it in the old office.
Ah.
Don't want to go back there.
No. I've still got my card, though. I could get in.
Graham's got my card, so he can get in and pretend he hasn't.
Shh.
Oh, dear. So, anyway, Voice of the Masses now, in which we asked, what's your dream distro? Now, again... Oh, hang on, sorry. So the hinterland of this question. Imagine you could gather together the best bits of every Linux distribution and create your numero uno, top-notch bee's knees distro to rule the world. What would it look like? It probably wouldn't have Elementary's funding model, that's for sure. But if we asked this question, say, maybe 3 years ago, then we would probably have had a fairly even split between Ubuntu and Fedora with a bit of Mandriva thrown in. But that just hasn't happened this time. The comments are just so diverse, people's responses. We've just scrolling down. We've got Debian, Crunchbang, Ubuntu, Linux Mint Debian Edition, Arch, Ubuntu, Debian, Ubuntu, Arch. Ah, so actually, yeah, Ubuntu is performing quite strongly. There's just lots of breakfast cereal out there for us all to try.
Does anyone have their own, you know, vision of a Franken distro that they'd like to bolt bits together and create the perfect one? Maybe if you were to take Ubuntu and add a lightweight LXDE interface, Mike.
Just like the other 50,000 similar distributions out there. I think I use Zubuntu as my main daily driver, as the cool kids say. And I do like rolling release distros as well for desktop applications. I don't like the base system constantly shifting under my feet. I know people can make that work. Arch Linux is surprisingly reliable for that, but I'd like a distro where all the base system, the kernel, glibc, X-server, stays the same for 6 months, a year, even 2 years, but you get rolling release updates for desktop applications. I think there are some distros like that. In fact, I think Manjaro might be a bit like that, but I live 1 week in the future, not 1 week in the past, so I can't use it.
Rolling releases is one of the features that people name in terms of mixing their own distro. But Jess points out, the perfect distro is one that, having been tweaked over months to your perfect working playing environment, doesn't disintegrate with the next upgrade. Distros are moving targets, rarely the same one year to the next, and each upgrade wrecks as many things as it fixes. Even rolling releases merely spread the destruction over time rather than pile it on at one big hit. Sounds like someone hasn't been reading the wiki. Graham, you don't read the wiki, do you? What do you think to rolling releases? What are the pros and cons?
Um, I, having used Arch for a few years, I think I couldn't go back to not using a rolling release distro. It's just always knowing that when I see an update on the internet to Linux kernel, for example, or something important or other applications, the new version of Firefox, it's great to know that really with effectively a single command or a single system update, I'll get all of that within a couple of days of it all being released. And it's kind of magical. It's what makes it all so exciting. But that's, for me, in a very specific usage environment where it's kind of important that I have all the latest stuff and see what's happening. If I was using I'd never use Arch in an office environment, for example, which I guess gets back to the breakfast cereals. There's definitely going to be more than one solution for this. But rolling releases for me, new features, getting the latest has always been one of the best parts of Linux. And I would like to have a more formalized rolling release distribution that doesn't break, just like Mike said. I'm surprised Manjaro maybe is the closest to that.
Have you tried Linux Mint Arch Edition?
No, I haven't.
Well, Burgess Meredith says, Arch is so good when it's working and Mint always works. Mint also knows that I don't care for the command line and I'm easily confused. Give me lots of configuration options, but please put them in a nice GUI. Playing with Antigos and Cinnamon on top right now. It's close, but not quite there.
Yeah,
the Mint people. I mean, it's... We do... hang on. Now, Safe says that all distros are the same, bar their configuration tools. Every distro potentially can install and run every application and every desktop environment. The principal differentiators are the tools that allow you to set up any individual's dream distro the way he or she wants it. That is true to an extent, but what Burgess Meredith says about Mint knows that I don't care for the command line. There's part of the personality of the creation team comes through in giving you these options and, you know, helping you make the right choices. Crunchbang was an excellent example of this. I mean, it's really, you know, it's Debian with was it OpenBox Window Manager, but there was thought put into the configuration and helping you to decide how you want it to work that goes beyond just bolting bits together.
Yeah, I think that's what most distributions find difficult. It's the same. I find it. Mint also does a brilliant job of with appearance, which I think is another neglected part of many Linux distributions. I really do think that Kubuntu, there's just a new Kubuntu coming out. You know, Kubuntu does a pretty good job of making KDE look good, but I think there's plenty of opportunity for people to make a much better looking KDE.
I haven't used Kubuntu in a while, but in the past I've always been really disappointed with it. The fact they haven't made it look that much better than vanilla KDE.
No, I don't think they do quite a lot to change it from the default KDE, but it doesn't. It's no more aesthetically pleasing. I think the latest KDE releases are looking a lot better than they used to. The Breeze theme and the new kind of flat Windows 8, 10-ish icons. I really like them.
I mean, when it comes down to distro design, it sort of reminds me of that Henry Ford quote or misquote that I've heard a few times. If you ask people what they wanted, they'd have said faster horses.
Of course.
I don't want someone to create the distro I know I can think that I want. I want something to come up with something better than I think I can want, but it turns out that's actually what I want, if that makes sense.
And I think that it's that kind of skill that the open source community is kind of lacking. Maybe it takes time, or it takes somebody being paid, you know, from some design academy somewhere to spend 2 years working on it. Because I don't see how we're going to get it from just a load of hackers wanting to pull their best bits together.
Well, I think that's what both Ubuntu and the GNOME team have tried with their latest iterations with Unity and GNOME 3. And I don't know. You can argue about whether or not they're succeeding.
They said they tried, and I haven't seen any evidence of it working when I put it in front of people.
I do like Unity, I have to say. I'm not using it at the moment. I've recently switched back to LXQT, but I do like Unity.
Well, moving on, channeling the spirit of Jonathan Swift, Ben says, in tomorrow's cloud-centric world, distros only need to be able to run a modern browser. Everything else is for those cursed with no internet. Connectivity is probably the most important household utility, well ahead of electricity, gas, running water or sewage. We could do without the rest as long as we can update our Facebook status using our solar-powered laptops, sipping recycled urine and cooking on the flames fuelled by old Linux Voice magazines. Thanks for the extra pages, folks. Now, that at first I thought that was a joke, but then if it's our Ben, he would probably agree.
Well, I am talking to you now via Chrome OS, and I can also do my IRC through my web browser.
Has Chrome OS been overhauled with Material Design?
I don't really understand what Material Design is, other than it's a bit squarier than old design.
Yeah. Flat and grey.
To be honest, it's just Chrome. It has some poppy-uppy things at the bottom, but other than that, it's just a browser window.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. There is no UI, really, in Chrome OS, is there? Yeah. Other than the settings panel, which is a bit of a hack of the Chrome browser's settings panel.
Yeah, I haven't even really looked at that, to be honest.
just going back to the faster horses thing, Mark C. says, my dream distro was Ubuntu 10.04. Yes, those halcyon days.
It was really good.
It was an LTS which was well supported and stable on my hardware, using GNOME 2 and with Ubuntu 1 to let me sync any of my files with a cloud server, rather than having to keep them in a special syncing folder. I tried Unity and GNOME 3, but they both wanted to enforce someone else's idea of a workflow on me rather than adapt to mine, so I moved to Linux Mint Mate Mate, but I do miss the simplicity of syncing backup that Ubuntu 1 provided.
I used Ubuntu 1 as well. It was really good. You could just, and it integrated so well with the file manager. You just clicked on a directory and said, I want this backed up, and it backed it up. And it kept it synchronized with the stuff on the server. It could get a little bit tangled if you had like stuff synchronized across machines and changing, updating distros and stuff, but it did work really well.
You know what? There are that many Linux distributions. What we need is some way of looking at all of them and working out which one's the best.
Good idea. That's a great idea.
Is that a good idea? Yeah.
Let's do it.
Let's put that in the magazine.
Let's be ambitious. Let's look at 50.
50 sounds good.
50? Is that surely that's too many? Surely we couldn't manage that, such a huge number of distros.
Oh, how about 49 then?
Oh, that sounds achievable.
Yeah. No, come on, cowards, let's go for 100.
He's out of control.
Is there 1,000 distros?
Yeah, 998 of them are just Ubuntu rip-offs.
Well, it's just as well that we've got 114 pages, more than any other Linux and free software magazine on the market. Hugh says, it depends. If I'm running late, a granola-topped yogurt will do, but if time is on my side, I'll happily download a big bowl of fruit and nut muesli. Keeps me going for hours, that does. Yes, this is a reference to cereal metaphor.
I find myself wanting yogurt with some granola on it now.
Yeah, so in short, many, many answers, not really grouped around a theme. Arch pops up quite a lot. People are pro and anti rolling releases. Also, despite its criticism it gets, Ubuntu is still performing very strongly. Turns out that people quite like it.
The one thing I know is that people still sort of settled on the ideas that we currently have in distros. And I'm a bit more ambitious on this. If I want my dream distro, it's something that it's got stuff that should be there that's not in current distros. Like, for example, we talked about rolling release versus stable. There's no reason why you can't really combine the two. The only reason they're separate is because we've got this idea that you can only have one version of each piece of software installed on your distro. But there's actually no reason why that should be the case. That's just the modern architecture. For example, this is something that I think Nixos tries to address with you can have atomic updates and rollbacks, so you can install a wide variety of the same tool on the distro. So you can have both the current version and a stable version running, and you just go to whichever one you want for the particular thing you're running. It's also something that you could do with like a Dockerized system, where you can have both a rolling release and a stable version together. And
I always wonder how they deal with configuration files in this case, though, is if you've got foo app version 1 and foo app version 2 on the same system and they both share .foo in your home directory, couldn't that mess things up?
I mean, it could, but you can also... I don't know the best way of doing this, but you can do it something like an overlay. So you have your .foo configuration file, then you have your sort of a changes version. You can sort
of using ButterFS.
Yeah. Or CoreOS have their own thing for doing it as well, I believe, for managing configurations across a vast number of virtual servers. It's a problem that, yeah, you need to address, but it's not an impossible problem.
Do you think this might be solved if there was like a decent or one package manager to rule them all so that we could download the latest version of Firefox to any distribution?
You mean if there was a systemd package manager?
yeah.
it could work. I don't think the package manager itself is the problem. It's the... We're sort of stuck, I think, in quite an antiquated way of managing software on Linux. And it works, but I think there's a way of working better that we're not currently using. And I'm not 100% sure what the right solution is, but I think we need more, I don't know, experimentation in that area rather than just saying, this one's got a slightly newer version than that, or this one's got a different wallpaper to that distro. I think the core, the very heart of the distros is still all based on the same model, with a couple of exceptions.
Yeah, you're right. And to drag this on a bit longer, you're right. Not so long ago, like 10 years ago or however long it is, 12 years ago, there was RPM, there was Deb. The two of them were still very much different kind of package management systems. And then you had Mandrake with URPMI. And then Ubuntu came along, which kind of made Deb much more usable with PPAs. And there was quite a bit, I wouldn't call it innovation, but there was diversity, which has just stopped.
Yeah, I mean, it just feels like they're different package formats for the same philosophy, really, of packages.
Yeah. They should merge RPM and DPG now.
Let's leave the last word to Connie, who says, whenever I dream of a distro, no, it is not that often, it seems to be able to read my thoughts and can give me unparalleled control of the universe through a simple sudo command on my neurally connected terminal. But I am unable to remember my password. I usually wake up just as I get the password right.
At least no one said Android.
Let's leave the second to last word to Connie. So that's it then.
Yes.
I thought you were going to say something else.
No, that was it. That was the last word went to Ben, but the second last word went to Connie.
Okay. So that's it for episode 6. That felt quite snappy.
Yeah, now we can all go out and enjoy the sunshine.
Yeah.
I can't.
Oh, well.
Okay, so thanks everyone. Thanks for listening. We'll see you all again in 2 weeks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.